Well, it's so good to see all of you that were able to make trumpets. And we miss, of course, our brethren in El Paso, but we have some plans after the feast to visit there and visit Sierra Vista as well. And wish everybody get well during this time of the year. Thankfully, it's getting to be a little cooler, thankfully. It's about time, right? It's about time. So the leaves aren't turning yet. In fact, we don't have any leaves in this town, but oh my. It'll be December before they fall to the ground, right, in most cases. So as kids, my brother and I, to a lesser extent my sister, she was youngest, but Hugh and I were fascinated with the stories of World War II, and it hadn't really, when we were growing up as kids in the 50s, it hadn't really been that long since there was a world war, a major world war of incredible consequence. And so those of you that grew up in the 50s and those of you that were maybe even adult in the 50s remember that there were a lot of shows, even about war. There are a lot of shows about cowboys and Indians, TV shows. There are a lot of shows about World War II. Korean War, I don't think they really memorialized that much at all. Well, maybe in MASH with the movie and then the series later on. But when we were kids, we learned all about World War II in our history classes and even from the personal experience of many of our parents. Dad just never talked too much about his war experience. And for a lot of the GIs from America, their war experience was... for a lot of people, I mean, it began with D-Day invasion in 1944. There were months and years of training prior to that, and then there was. But a lot of Americans battled from 1941 on, not my dad. But even though his time in warfare was not all that long, about a year or so, until they released, he finally drove into Germany, and, they were kind of doing a police action there after the war, after the surrender of the nation of Germany and their allies. But he was very reluctant to talk about any of those experiences. It was not something he really wanted to dwell on. So he did have a kind of a scrapbook of pictures taken during the time of the war, and we would ask him questions about those. And those memories, I think my brother has kept a lot of that intact, thankfully, for the history of the family. There was a book that his division, his infantry division, made after the war, and it was solely due to the exploits and the work of the 29th Division, which was a National Guard division for the most part, but it had gone back all the way to the time of the armies of General Washington. Now, I think I've explained this. Some of you may have remembered this, but my father survived the Omaha invasion, Omaha Beach invasion, and though they were due to land at 6:30 in the morning, through either a malfunction of their landing craft or divine intervention, we don't know, but they landed on a sandbar instead, few hundred yards offshore. So they didn't make it in at 6:30 in the morning, and that's when the heaviest casualties were suffered by the American forces. You know, your dad is always a hero to you. He's the dad that can beat up all the other dads. He's the strongest dad, and it's probably the way it should have been. My father was relatively older than many of his colleagues at 26. In fact, that was his birthday, the day of the D-Day invasion. And he was probably 5-6 years older than most of the GIs. And eventful as that day was, he told me later, kind of had to pry things out of him, that every day afterwards was as intense as landing on Omaha Beach. And those of you that have studied the movements and the patterns of the armies as they invaded France know that that's true. They had danger around every corner and danger across every hedgerow. In the garage today, I have some films, and these are from the 29th Infantry Division. There's no narration. They're silent. And because I pestered him so much for information about D-Day in 1994, the 50th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, you know, he sent me a bunch of stuff. And I put them in the VHS player at the time and watched them. They're ugly. They're horrific. There are, you know, even without, there's no music, there's no romanticizing, there's pictures of people with half their heads blown off. There's horrible scenes of corpses lying in a field, tanks that have been decimated by artillery fire. So the photographers in that division took these. They're hideous, they're ghastly, they show the horrors, the awfulness of death and of war. Some of you who have been around for a long time remember that in Tucson for the local paper, the Arizona Daily Star, there was one, maybe a couple of writers when I actually got to paper years ago, and when that was, you know, the primary means of communication of local news. Her name was Bonnie Henry. Some of you may remember Bonnie Henry was a really excellent writer, and she did a series at the 50th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. And she wrote a series of articles, maybe 12 or 14 or so, and she interviewed people who were here locally that participated in the D-Day invasion. And it was an amazing series and a terrific job. And because I was really getting into the study of it and the interest of it 50 years after the fact in 1994, I called her up and asked her some questions about what motivated her, and I think in her case it was her father who was a veteran, and she interviewed all these people from Tucson that had participated, and they were inspiring stories, and it reminded me of a story of my father and his brothers that was in the Niagara Falls Gazette, and I still have most of that article that appeared in the Niagara Falls Gazette. It was like the local boys make good type of article, and it was a front page article that went on to, you know, several pages as well, documenting the movements of my father and his brothers throughout the war. And it shows that near the end of the war, my father met his younger brother for the first time in 3 or 4 years in Germany, just by happenstance. And that paper memorialized that particular meeting that they had. So I called Bonnie Henry, and we had a nice chat on the phone, and the lasting impressions that she left with me in interviewing the subjects that she had talked with were exactly the same as my conversations that I had with my father regarding his experiences. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to dwell on it. They just wanted to win the war and get back home and not talk about it ever again. And it wasn't until later, towards his later years of his life, that my brother and my sister and myself sat down with our father, and we actually heard some things about his war experiences that we had never heard before. But like most people, if your father was in the service or in the war, probably during that time, the memories are some that they just didn't want to recall, and they didn't glory in their service time. That was left for movies, and since that time, the actions of war have been sometimes very accurately portrayed in movies. One time we were going to play golf, my dad and myself. I was caddying for him. I was probably 12 years old. We were driving in a little town in southern Pennsylvania to get to the golf course, and Dad was sitting in the passenger seat. This is when cars were made out of metal. Even the dashboards were made out of, what were they thinking? Made out of heavy gauge metal. There wasn't any cushioning on a lot of them. This was a 1957 station wagon or of some kind, a Ford or a Chevy or something. So my dad is in the passenger seat, and we're driving through the stoplight, and all of a sudden the car backfired. I don't know if cars really backfire that much now, but a backfire sounds very much like a gunshot. And this would have been probably 1960, so let's say 15 years after the completion of the war. And at that that exhaust sound, my father immediately dove for the dashboard. Well, he's trying to dive under the dashboard because it was like incoming fire. And I remember he bashed his head on the dash of the car, the metal, probably 15-gauge metal. They don't have that in most cars today. But those experiences stuck with them. I think most of us as Americans would agree with this concept that the United States has been pretty reluctant to enter into war against other nations. You might get some argument from some Iraqis and some Afghanis about that, because those have been the longest and most expensive wars that we have ever fought in our history. An author by the name of Dominic Tierney wrote a book recently entitled The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. He writes, it's a limited war for Americans and total war for those fighting Americans. The United States has more power. Its foes have more willpower. It's really true, isn't it? Something in the prophecies talk about breaking the pride of our power, right? But he goes on to summarize that the foes of America have really no concern for innocent life, while America would rather sacrifice an American life than risk the loss of an innocent, a foreign innocent, as we would call them. It shows that it's really no way to wage war. He explains, the best military in the world is ineffective if a critical mass of our citizens lack the will to deploy it effectively and then endure through adversity. In fact, those two concepts are related. The perception of effectiveness is inextricably linked to the willingness to endure. Americans are losing the will to fight because we first lack the willingness to deploy the military effectively. I think this book was probably written prior to the last election. Who knows what's going to happen? The will seems to be renewed in the presidency of Donald Trump, but we'll just have to wait and see. No predictions from me as to how that will happen. What does the Bible say about war? And what did God foresee about the future of mankind and warfare? Did he prohibit his people, his chosen nation Israel, from going to war? As we know, the good news is that there is an end to wars coming in the future, and beginning with the return of Jesus Christ, which we just celebrated, it shows us that the end of wars is going to come upon mankind. But in keeping with the theme of the Feast of Trumpets, there's only one thing that will end war. War. The war of God against mankind. Now, let's take a look at a dictionary definition of war. I chose the Oxford English Dictionary for a little bit of humor. The Oxford English Dictionary says, a state of armed conflict between different countries or different groups within a country. Civil war, we've known that in this country. A state of competition or hostility between different peoples or groups. A sustained campaign against an undesirable situation or activity. That's terribly British, if you follow. They've burned our city, slaughtered our women and children. That would be an undesirable situation, according to the British. I thought it was humorous, but I guess wrong in this case. So there is no biblical record of wars being fought prior to the flood, but it's hard to imagine the world becoming so evil that God would destroy it all without there being wars. So my guess is that there were probably wars aplenty for the first 1,600 years after mankind's creation. In fact, the first mention of war is found in Genesis 14. And you're really familiar with this particular instance. And it was a war that God's people were just caught up in as innocent bystanders. And Abram had to intervene. Not that they certainly weren't a part of starting this war, but here are a bunch of pagan kings around Sodom and Gomorrah. The area appears to be in the area of Arabia, the area that would be very close to Petra. That's kind of identified in this area, so that appears to be the general area of the Middle East in which it was. And so the chapter details a lot of these kings getting together. It doesn't show what the real origin of the war is, except the wars are usually fought because somebody else has something that another person wants, or they've had an argument, or it's escalated, or they want the wealth of other nations, and so we don't know. But we do find that a number of kings in verse 4 for 12 years served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled against this king and his oppression. And in the 14th year of that king, the kings that were with him came and attacked Rephaim and a lot of other folks. I'm not going to go through the pronunciation of all those. Okay, so we know that there was war. And we know that Lot got caught up in this as an innocent bystander and in this war that took place. And they were taken captive along with a lot of other folks. And in verse 13, it says, "One who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother Eshcol and his brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan." Now, pacifism, which is an ideology which is totally against any kind of conflict at all, would lead some people to believe that the best course of action would be to sit and wait, not really do anything about this, not try to provoke the enemy any further, and maybe just pray about it. I mean, if they did, if the pacifists pray, I don't know if they did. But Abram didn't do that. And he's not condemned by God for taking action and defending himself and his family and his nephew against this war. And so he armed his servants. And God does not condemn him in any way for arming himself to take care of his family at all. It might surprise some people if they actually read the Bible, but he at least had some knowledge or ability to be a war strategist, because he divided his army up into three separate groups and attacked the enemy on three separate fronts. And now we don't know if he was outnumbered or if he just skillfully deployed his troops, and that was the difference in addition to God's protection. But we do know the results in verse 16. "So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh," that is the king's valley, "after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High." The book of Hebrews explains that this Melchizedek was the Christ. He wasn't Shem, or else they would say Shem came out to greet him. No, Shem was not a priest of the Most High God, but Jesus Christ is our high priest. So the one who later on, as John says, would leave the throne of God and become a human was this individual that greeted Abram when he came back from his conquest, simply to save his family. So by implication, it appears as though that intervention by Abram or going to war was certainly not wrong. And we don't see any condemnation for anything that he did. But he blessed, in fact, God had a victory party for Abram, a victory celebration with bread and wine, and I'm sure there were other foods as well. Met him, congratulated him. Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hands. It shows that God does deliver enemies of his people into their hands, but there was action taken. They didn't just sit and wait. God, please go get Lot for me. Bring him back safely. No, they're people of action. And he gave him a tithe of all. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. Yeah, give me the Sodomites and the people that have been taken. You keep everything. But Abram said to the king, I've raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. And obviously that wasn't the case. Any man that has 300 servants has got to be a wealthy person. I don't know about you. I don't have any servants. You have you have Mr. Dines as your servant. Okay, well, it's nice. It'd be nice for you to tell him someday, okay? So, except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me. So let them take their portion. So they're deserving of some of the spoils of war, some of the goods. So that's the first mention of war in the Bible. I mean, from the chronological standpoint of man's beginning. But it's not the first war in the Bible. Now, that took place, we're guessing, I don't know, maybe long, long, long before that, and we're coming up to the time in which we'll investigate this further. We'll investigate it today. Maybe we don't need to investigate it further on the Day of Atonement next Sabbath. But in Isaiah chapter 14, the first recording of war, or conflict, or determination to overthrow in a competitive sense, happened in the heavens. It happened in the heavens. In Isaiah chapter 14, in verse 12, the fate of this war is recorded. How you were fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you're cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. Now, the nations hadn't been weakened yet, but he was the one that does. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, the other angels. And I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. I'm not sure what the NIV says, but there are some translations that say, I will be the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Now, Ezekiel 28 also describes this conflict, but you knew that. And the competition of this angelic being who tried to take over the throne, the power, and the majesty of God. So, you might say that God was engaged in a war at some point after the creation of the angelic beings. Time, I don't know if that's relevant, but to spirit, you know, getting into the metaphysical, we don't have Einstein around to help us understand exactly what that all means. I'm sure he could some way, but God was engaged in war with his creation. Or his creation was engaged in war against him. So he defended himself, but he allowed the continuance of this being. Now, if you'll turn to Deuteronomy chapter 20, you'll see that with the establishment of a nation, it appears as though this would be a foregone conclusion that Israel would be involved in warfare at some point. And the ancient rules of engagement for warfare were given by God Almighty to the nation of Israel. This is how you will conduct yourselves in war. Despite what everybody else does as a nation now, and this was just before they were going into the land, this Deuteronomy means repeat. This information was given to them as they were about to take on the land, and have a conquest of the land that God intended for them. And it's really an interesting read. It's really kind of interesting as to how they were to conduct themselves long before they ever went to battle. Let's take a look. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. You're going to go to war. The pacifist would say, God shouldn't have allowed them to go to war. God shouldn't have allowed his people to war. But it was a foregone conclusion, I'm guessing, from the Garden of Eden, that there were going to be these kinds of things that would happen. There would be war. It would be a natural occurrence of life. So it shall be when you're on the verge of battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people. The Levites would come out. Now, I don't know that there's any history that shows that this happened. You could say, you could discern possibly that when Joshua went out to battle, you know, the priests are marching around leading the army. You probably say that these things were probably done. I guess they were. But it was quite different than anybody else did it. So we're in the verge of the battle that the priest shall approach and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you're on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint. Do not be afraid. Do not tremble or be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. But they would have to fight as well. And they did. Then the officer shall speak to the people, saying, What man is there who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? How did they dedicate it? I'm not sure. And not like dedicating a boat, you know, with a bottle of champagne across the front porch. Maybe hadn't inhabited it yet. Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it. Okay, you just built a house? You're excused for military service. It's not the way it was for me in the 1960s. I had to wait for the little tumbling ball to come down with a number, and you know, it was like the lottery. It was a lottery. Oh, number 319, safe. I don't know what my number was, but I had a number. Everybody that was 18 and over eventually got a number from the years of, 65 to 74. You had a low number. You had a very good chance of dying in war. So you could get a student deferment, which I did. A lot of people did. Held on to that for as long as I could. Vietnam War was the first war that was really played nightly on the news. And it didn't look like fun. Didn't look very nice at all. It really kind of took away the will of the American people to be over in Southeast Asia. Well, going on. Also, what man is there who has planted a vineyard and has not eaten of it? You haven't had the grapes yet? You're excused. That's a little different, isn't it? You wouldn't get by with that if they had a conscription army today. I'm from Sonoma County. Guess what? War board, or you know, whatever they were called. What would they call them? Draft board. Yeah, draft board. Yeah. Draft board from Sonoma County, going to Marin, the county seat, or whatever it is. Can't go. Why not? Just planted some grapes. Oh, okay, that's good. Good, you're out. This is pretty humane. Just because you didn't eat the grapes yet. You know, there'd be a chance you'd die in battle and another man eat of it. Okay, what man is there who's betrothed to a woman and has not married her? You're engaged? You're going to get married? Yeah, you know, people get engaged now, and I've had friends that... Oh, we're engaged. I'm thinking the marriage is coming up really soon. People get engaged, and they'll get married for 2 or 3 years. That's the way it goes a lot of times with the younger folks. Not you people. You people are older. People get engaged. Yeah, I mean, when we were engaged, we were ready to get married the next day. But, you know, we had to plan for a wedding, so it was 6 months away, right? It was none of this years away from things. So, okay. I would assume that there was a normal time, a not 2 year period, but let him go return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man marry her. Now you get excused. It's never been the case in modern times. The officer shall speak further to the people and say, what man is there who is fearful and faint-hearted? Oh, you're scared? Get out. You know, that doesn't work today. You don't want to fight? Beat it. There's some logic to that, right? You don't want this fear infiltrating the rest of the troops. You want everybody that's ready, able, and willing to go to battle with you. You don't want some scaredy cat next to you in the foxhole. So those could go. And when you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. Oh, there's this nation. And it shall be, if they accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found in it shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. Now, if the city will not make peace with you, but make war against you, then you shall besiege it. You go to war against them. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hands, you shall strike every male of it in it with the edge of the sword. They all die. But the women, the little ones, livestock, all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall plunder for yourself, and you shall eat the enemy's plunder which the Lord your God gives you. Thus you shall do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not the cities of these nations, but the cities of these peoples which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. You shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. Now we find later on in history, this sounds bad, right? Sounds horrible, cruel, blah, blah. But again, you have to revisit the history of those nations and see what those people were doing and what their religion was leading them to do. And when you do that, it begins to make a lot more sense as to why God called for the total extinction of those folks. And you find that in the book of Judges, and you find that they disobeyed and they didn't do what they were told to do. And so the other caveat that they made was that don't do something really stupid, like cut down an apple tree to make fortification against the city, because that apple tree, you might be there for a while. That's the assumption. You might be there for a long time, and you don't want to cut down the tree that might provide you something to eat later on. All the other trees, fine, cut them down. Use them for an embankment. Use them to build towers or whatever they would to go to war. So the point is that the rules for these armies of God, these armies of ancient Israel, were quite different than today. And God allowed it, and God allowed them to go to war. And war was a part and a parcel of the world that Israel grew up in. And going forward into the history of Israel, we see that people really didn't have the stomach to do exactly what God said. First two chapters of Judges show the failure of Israel to implement God's instruction of warfare. Now, moving way ahead thousands of years into the book of Micah, we see that their descendants, the descendants of these people, are shown to be a very powerful people, the people of today. The people of modern Israel, the people that are us. They're shown to be incredible people with great power. It's after Jonah. Micah chapter 5 and verse 7. The clue that this is an end time prophecy, or when I say end time, this is a very general thing. The time in which Israel came to power, which began in the 1800s and extends up to now. But the remnant gives us a clue that it might be at the very edge of that time period, the very last of that time period. And it says, the remnant of Jacob, and that's Israel, shall be in the midst of many peoples. That's the U.S. and Britain in prophecy, in Bible prophecy. Jacob is Israel. You could say the 12 tribes, but no, this is more specifically Jacob, and Jacob named his name on the heads of Ephraim and Manasseh in Genesis 49. But this remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like due from the Lord. Due from the Lord. Like showers on the grass that wait for no man, nor wait for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, who, if he passes through, both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. It's a good description of a lot of our history in the United States and Britain from the time that they rose to power. Not always, and not always so recently as well. But it's a brief prophecy about the probable success of Israel in battle through history. But the next verse provides one of the most pivotal phrases in all the Bible, in all of Bible prophecy. It's in that day. In that day. Now, through the prophets, I cataloged where those words in the same verse occur. In that day. Now, you can look these up or you can do your own search. Doesn't mean that in that day appears in all these places. But it appears a lot. I didn't go through because sometimes it can be a word in and then later on in the sentence that, and then the end of the sentence it's day. So it doesn't appear consecutive. But in that day consecutively appears a lot in Bible prophecy. And it means various things according to the context. In Isaiah, these words, not that particular instance. You see the difference? 53 times, Jeremiah 34, Lamentations 3, Ezekiel 28, Daniel 4, Hosea 6, Joel 2, Amos 6, Obadiah 2, Micah 7, Habakkuk 1, Zephaniah 4, Haggai 1, Zechariah 23. And many of those times, it is the exact phrase in that day. Sometimes it's not. I didn't want to look up. That's what I looked that up. I forgot to write it down. It's I think a couple of hundred, maybe 200 to 300 different instances, and I wasn't going to. I mean, I love my sermon prep, okay, but I don't want to look up 300 occurrences of in that day. But these are the occurrences in which in that and day appear in the same verse, and many of them follow the sequence of in that day. And to find out when that day is, you just examine the context and it's revealed to you. A lot of times, sometimes it means the time of Israel's fall in prophecy. Sometimes it does, as in this time. In the next verse, in verse 10, it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that I will cut off your horses from your midst. It would indicate that even at a time of relative power of a nation, that this particular destruction can come upon it. And destroy your chariots, and I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds. I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no soothsayers. Your carved images I will also cut off, and your sacred pillars from your midst. You shall no more worship the work of your hands. Now, this obviously happened in ancient Israel as God brought them to destruction. Prophecy is often dual in nature. And although we don't have necessarily wooden images that we worship, we have cities that can be destroyed, and we have departed from God. I will execute vengeance and anger and fury on the nations that have not heard. So sometimes it means the time of Israel's fall. Sometimes it refers to what we began talking about on the Feast of Trumpets, the day of the Lord, the time in which God begins after the great tribulation and the signs of the heaven, then the day of the Lord, when he begins to set his hand to intervene in the affairs of mankind. Let's turn to Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah, even in this chapter, this one lone chapter, in that day appears six times. So it's a pivotal phrase used in Bible prophecy. Let's take a look. First in verse 3. And it shall happen in that day, that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, although all nations of the earth are gathered against it. You know, that is a focal point of Bible prophecy, right? Israel being surrounded, the abomination that makes desolate, maybe a pagan temple, maybe a pagan edifice in a renewed temple, whatever. We'll know it when it happens. But Jerusalem, surrounded by all these armies, surrounded by a beast power. Of course, all the other nations of the world, all the surrounding nations that surround small little tiny piece of Judah now, would like to drive them into the sea. That's what they want. The very hostile land, hostile place to be in. It's not going to work. Anybody that does it, bad for you. Not going to happen. Heavy stone. You know, everybody's going to try to lift it. Huge mistake. God will exact his vengeance and his punishment on them. Verse 4, I will in that day, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Just not going to happen. Verse 6, in that day, I will make the governors of Judah like a fire pan in the woodpile and like a fiery torch in the sheaves. They shall devour all the surrounding peoples on the right hand and on the left. Now that little, tiny little group of Jews is apparently going to have some success in warfare, and God's going to allow it. Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, Jerusalem. In verse 8, in that day the Lord will defend all the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. It shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. That surely is speaking of the day of the Lord. In verse 11, in that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning in Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. And the land shall mourn, every family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, and the wives by themselves, the family of the house of Nathan by itself. So there will be tragedy. Judah will prevail. God will allow that to happen. He will allow some war to happen at that particular time. Now, Zechariah chapter 14, it shows that the day of the Lord is filled with war, 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 and more war. A continual siege on this earth. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, and I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half the city shall go into captivity. But the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem. We read that on the Day of Trumpets. It's the day of the Lord. Our entire human history has been filled with violence and killing and hatred. And it really is nothing more difficult than it being the consequence of a wrong way of thinking, a wrong attitude of mankind. Hold your place here in Zechariah. Let me read just a bit from the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43. And obviously, as you know, therein lies a lesson for all of us, right? Because we are the people of God. And it's a reminder to us that we have already engaged upon this journey and upon this new way of thinking and this revolutionary attitude. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Well, that's the lofty ideal to which we aspire, that we would understand that even our enemies are conceived in the framework of God and Jesus Christ, and that they have the ultimate potential of being in the family of God a little further out in the plan. You know, the disciples of Christ evidently carried swords with them. They did. I'm not saying you need to carry a sword. You should probably carry a gun. No, I'm only kidding. Just kidding. I hope you know that I was just kidding. But they carried swords. They were protecting themselves. They were ready to defend Jesus Christ the night that he was grabbed. But this attitude was far-reaching, and that's the attitude that will be embraced by all mankind in the future, that they will be able to recognize somebody can do you wrong, but you still have a responsibility to pray for that individual, even in this life. It doesn't mean that a Christian allows himself to be taken advantage of, is a doormat, or any such thing. But it is a totally different way of thinking than exacting vengeance upon the individual who has wronged you. So back to Revelation chapter 14 and verse 12. This shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. And yep, ever since the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, that scene in which they do something wrong by opening up the ark and releasing these angelic beings, which I don't think that was ever in the original script. And by original script, I mean the Bible, that angels are contained inside the Ark of the Covenant. But you get the point. You remember the scene, right, Sam? The flesh melts in cinematographic glory. I think I said that right. It captures it so well, that one scene. And that apparently is what happens. Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet, and their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. It shall come to pass in that day that the great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. Judah will also fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. Such also shall be the plague on the horse, the mule, the camel, the donkey, and all the cattle that will be in those camps. So shall this plague be. Now, with the Feast of Trumpets, Christ returns, defeats the beast power, and then is attacked and attacks all the nations that choose to engage in warfare against him. You can hold your place here in Zechariah once again, and we'll just turn briefly to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 19. And the important verses here for my sake are verses 11 through 21. Where Christ returns as a man of war. And I think there's actually even a piece called The Lord is a Man of War. I think it's in Handel's Messiah. Seems that we sang part of that when I was in the Ambassador College chorale. You can't find those words in the Bible, but he is returning as a man of war. And he's going to strike the nations with a rod of iron, as it says in verse 15. And then verse 20, we'll skip down. The beast was captured, with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image, and these two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone, and the rest were killed with a sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. So you can fill in here with a lot of other prophecies. Isaiah 63 is a prominent one, where Obadiah, the descendants of Obadiah, are attacked. and the book of Obadiah, where there is a virtual slaughter of an entire generation. Everyone killed, slaughtered. It's horrific. And so ends the war to end all wars, which we thought was World War I. Or, that's what many people might have commonly assumed, that this war that God wreaks on the nations will end it all. But it won't. It won't. If you go back to verse 16 of Zechariah, this is what we call, Zechariah 14, this is what we call a conditional prophecy. This prophecy does not have to be fulfilled. Now, it's conditional in that, you know, you do this, you're going to get this. You do the right things, you're going to be blessed. You do bad things, you're going to get cursed. So it may not ever happen. Let's hope it doesn't. Let's hope it never comes to this in the millennium. It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem, all these hideous foes, these angry people, this hostility all whipped up into a fervor by the devil, all this hate and anger and zeal to kill, it's all going to be changed around. They're all going to be keeping the Feast of Tabernacles every year. The line from the 1939 coworker letter from Mr. Armstrong still is etched in my memory. When there had been some who hadn't come to Eugene for the feast for a couple of years, there weren't that many people. But he quoted this scripture because he was chastising some of the members who hadn't come to the feast. And he said, "Are you finally going to come to the feast when Christ returns?" It's not an exact quote, but he quoted this scripture. "And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain." Well, that's not a war. But there's no rain. "If the family of Egypt will not come in and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and a punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." So it's a plague. You might say it's kind of a war waged against those nations, more of a civil type of, and not civil, not intra, but a more civil way of addressing the issues with them, withholding rain, kind of an attack against them. I would say it's kind of a war, but you may argue. Doesn't really matter. We're both right. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 4. "But for the most part, 1,000 years of no war is on the horizon. Very soon, 1,000 years of no war." And Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 4 says, "Neither shall they learn war anymore." In Pennsylvania, we have a college devoted to war. It's the War College. Look it up. It's a college devoted to the instruction of war, how to be successful in warfare, and the strategies of war. So if you're going to go to war, you better be good at it rather than really bad at it. Because to be really bad at it means to die and to lose, right? Be good at it. Go to the College of War. But isn't that silly? How much wealth, how much intellect, how many resources have been devoted just for war? Even in our nation, where we're a nation which predominantly, we have been a nation that desires to prevent wars and not go to wars. And it was said, and I think very truly, by the most current Egyptian president, who I saw an interview with Sean Hannity the other night, who said that the United States is responsible for defending the free world and, in fact, preventing war. And he recognizes that. Of all the people we let into this country, maybe we should let him get into this country and come to this country, because he knows more about the role of the United States and what it could do and would do than a lot of people do. But the world will no longer, according to Isaiah, waste its resources, its time, and precious lives going to battle against one another. And I suppose at some point it will just have to be taught in schools that there was a time when there were wars. Wars, what's that? Little kids won't know anything. I mean, in my day, it was okay to have a little toy pistol and play cops and robbers and war. You know, we had BB guns, and not even before BB guns, we had rifles and stuff, not real ones. We had those things, and we played war. As little kids, that was one of the things we did. We played war. There were shows that were on TV about war, and we didn't really think anything about it or think it was a bad thing. I gotcha. I mean, we're little kids, 6, 7, 8. We're having fun. Neither shall they learn war anymore. That won't be a thing for our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-great-great-grandchildren. They won't even know what we're talking about, except they should be taught it in school, most likely. And so ends war forever. Not so fast. Not really. Let's go to Revelation chapter 20. 1,000 years of peace, but not the end of war. Revelation 20 and verse 7. Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. Yeah, this author of war, the one that has inspired people with the ideas of how to strategize in war. It comes from him. The Art of War, the Chinese philosopher wrote. Famous book. The Art of War. And will go out and deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up in the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and the fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Then the devil will be dealt with. Now, that's the end of wars. Who are these people? Why does it happen? How does this deception occur? We'll explore these topics at a later time. Be here October 21st. We'll take a look at it. One of the most famous war generals of the Civil War was General William Tecumseh Sherman. He was a great general. And he was a brilliant mind. He hated war, but he was really good at waging war. He had a number of quotes which are really brilliant quotes, but some of his best quotes are about war. He said, "You might as well appeal against a thunderstorm as against these terrible hardships of war. War is cruelty. There's no use in trying to reform it. The crueler it is, the sooner it will be over." True. "It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell." Yes, it is. But thankfully, it's coming to an end.